Starting it. Right. Right. Okay. Good evening. Now, this mimer, the Rebbe said in 1970, he actually said it on Purim, and it was printed in the Dvar Malchus for this week, and I thought it would be a good mimer for us to study together. It's a rather long mimer, so we're going to be taking quite, like long, large steps, as it were, through it, just taking things in general. And the text that it's about is about the Torah reading, which is on Purim. Now, this coming Shabbat is called Shabbat Parshat Zachor, remember, and we read from a second Torah scroll on Shabbat about the command to remember what Amalek did. The point being that Amalek was the wicked nation which attacked us after we'd come out of Egypt, who was not impressed, you could say, with any of the miraculous aspects of our coming out of Egypt, the plagues against the Egyptians, our victory at the Red Sea. All this didn't mean anything to Amalek, and they simply attacked us. And so then comes the command that later in the Torah as well, that we should remember what Amalek did. And so that is what is read from another Torah scroll. That's from Sedra Ki Teitzeh in Deuteronomy. That will be read from a second Torah scroll this Shabbat. And then on Purim itself, the Torah reading is about the account of the attack by Amalek, the point and their defeat, and the way in which Moses, when he held up his hands, the Jewish people were winning, and when he lowered his hands, they were losing. So the connection with Purim is that in the Megillah, it tells us that Haman, this prime hater of the Jewish people, was Haman Ha-Agagi, descended from Agag, and Agag was the king of Amalek in the time of King Saul. King Saul was supposed to apply the command of wiping out the nation of Amalek when there's a group of people who are total evil, unredeemable evil. Then the only thing way forward is wiping them out, and this is what God commanded concerning Amalek. However, Saul did not do that properly, and one of the effects was that the king Agag was able to have relations with a woman and sire a child who was the ancestor of Haman. And so there is the connection between Amalek and Purim. And so here we have in front of us the text from the Torah in Sedra B'Shalach in Exodus. That's the Sedra which tells about the crossing, the splitting of the sea, the drowning of the Egyptians. And Vayavo Amalek, Amalek came, Vayilachem Yisrael b'Refidim, and it battled against Israel at a place called Refidim. Now the word Refidim, Rafa, means to be weak. And so the sages say because the Jewish people were weak in their sense of connection with God, that was why Amalek was able to conquer them. Vayomer Moses said to Joshua, Bechar lanu anashim, choose for us men to fight. Vetzei hilachem ba'Amalek, go and fight Amalek. Machor, tomorrow, Anochi nitzav al rosh hagivah, I will stand at the top of the hill, umateh elokim biyadi, and the staff, the divine staff with which he split the sea, that staff will be in my hand. And Joshua did this, and Moshe, Aaron, and Hur, they went up to the head, the top of this hill. Vahaya kasher yarim Moshe yado, when Moses would lift up his hands, would keep his hands above, back upwards, v'gavar Yisrael, the Jewish people would be successful in this battle. V'chasher yaniach yado, but when he lowered his hands, v'gavar Amalek, then Amalek would be successful. And so there's the whole idea here that Moshe's hands were heavy, and so they got a large stone and they put it underneath him, and he sat on that, and Aaron and Hur on either side, they held his hands, and so they were able to keep his hands upwards. And as a result, Yahushua was able to defeat Amalek. And God said to Moses, "K'tov zot zikaron ba'sefer, write this as a memory in a book, put it in the ears of Joshua, ki macho emcheh zecha Amalek. I will wipe out the memory of Amalek under the heavens." And Moshe built an altar and called it Hashem is my miracle. And he said, "Ki yad al keis yudkei, my hand is on the throne of God. Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek mido do. There is a battle between God and Amalek from generation to generation throughout the ages," as they put it here. So that is the extra Torah reading, which is that's the Torah reading which is said on Purim itself, and that is what this Maimer, this discourse, is about, and it's a discourse of 1970, as mentioned. Oh, So this is the discourse on Purim, 1970. It has not been edited by the Rebbe. V'haya kasher yarim Moshe yado v'gavar Yisrael. When Moses was able to keep his hands upwards, then the Jewish people were successful in their battle against Amalek. V'tzarich lavin. Now we have to understand this, asks the Rebbe in the discourse. Harei b'milchemet Amalek, in this battle against Amalek, hayu b'nei Yisrael b'ma'amad u'matzav sheze ata yatzu mimitzrayim. They were in a very positive situation. They'd just come out of Egypt. There they'd seen amazing wonders, amazing miracles in a revealed way. Then they came to the splitting of the Red Sea. And there, the splitting of the Red Sea, as we say in the Song of the Sea, that is Oz Yoshiah, which we say every day as part of the daily prayers, Ze Keli Va'anveihu, this is my God, and I will make a home for him in my heart. Ze, literally, this is my God. Every individual Jew was able to see tangibly godliness around them. And so that's real revelation of the divine. So it's an incredible thing. And even so, in order, they're on such a spiritual high, in order that they should be able to be successful in this battle, they needed something special. They needed that Moses should keep his hands upwards. Now it says about this in the Mishnah in Tractate Rosh Hashanah. It says, "V'chi yadav shel Moshe osot milchama." Was it the hands of Moses that were doing war? When he lifted up his hands, it meant the Jewish people were mistaklim klapi maila. They were lifting their eyes to heaven, to God. They were subjugating their heart to their Father in heaven. Then, Hayumit Gabrim, then they were successful in war. So, also this, we need an explanation. Why is it that in the battle against Amalek, they needed this? What about the whole battle to conquer the land of Israel? So the here, we've got this battle against one nation, Amalek, whereas the battle to conquer the land of Israel was actually a battle against seven different nations. And the sages tell us there were 31 kings. There were immense forces in Israel. And even so, we don't find this idea that Moses had to lift up his hands or anything in some way similar to it. We only find that with the battle against Amalek. So what is different about the battle against Amalek compared with the battle to conquer the whole land of Israel? One can suggest that similar to the idea of Moses lifting up his hands here, in the battle against Amalek in the time of King Saul, then for the first time, the Jewish people attempted to keep this command of wiping out Amalek. And so and that in fact is going to be in the Haftorah for this week's Sedra. So this week we have Zachor from Ki Tetzeh in Deuteronomy, in Dvarim, and the Haftorah will be the battle of Saul against Amalek. So it says, God says, I visited, I remembered what Amalek did against the Jewish people. Now, God says through the prophet, go and smite Amalek. Now, this was the battle against Agag, who was the king of Amalek. So that's there in the time of Saul. Similarly, in the time of Purim, as it says in the Mishnah, that on Purim we read this Torah text that we've actually been quoting now, Vayavo Amalek, that Amalek came and attacked the Jewish people. So it's actually written in a Mishnah that this should be the Torah reading on Purim. The reason was Lefi Shahaman Hagagi, because Haman, the Agagite, was one of the great-grandchildren, the descendants of Agag, who was from the seed of Amalek, and he's the person who was there in the time of King Saul. And so, and even the wiping out of Amalek that will be in the time, in the generation of King Mashiach, as it says in the Targum, when it says the phrase we just read, there's a battle for God with Amalek from generation to generation, that's talking about the generation of the King Mashiach. And then will be fulfilled this verse, Macho Emche, I will wipe out the memory of Amalek. You see, there are two different verses. One verse says, I, God, will wipe out the memory of Amalek. And there's another verse, which is in Ki Tetzeh, which says, you, the Jewish people, should wipe out the memory of Amalek. So there's two actions. There's from the Jewish people and there's from God. So in the time of Mashiach, the memory of Amalek will really be wiped out. As Rashi explains, that there won't be anything, nothing at all will be remembered from the time of Amalek. And so, I think what the Rebbe is saying here is that in that there is an aspect in that relates to Moses lifting his hands. So whatever Moses lifting his hands meant in the time of the going out of Egypt, there will be some kind of equivalent in the future as well. And that's what this discourse is going to explain. What is the special quality of Moses lifting his hands? We're not just talking about a battle between the Jewish people and the enemies. That's one aspect of it, and it's a very important aspect, the literal sense. But we're also talking about a spiritual battle. And to a certain extent, it's a spiritual battle that happens every single day for each individual. And so that is what we are trying to explore now. Now, first of all, just looking at it in terms of Amalek, it's one of the nations of the world. So we have the difference between Amalek and the seven nations who were in the land of Israel. And these seven nations, now here's in line 19, is an interesting point. These seven nations are Klalut HaShivim Umot. They are the general principle of the 70 nations. They in fact represent the 70 nations. That's because each one of those seven nations includes 10. So in other words, if you want to make a connection with what's happening at the moment in Israel and elsewhere, the 70 nations, the United Nations, it takes the part of the people of the Arabs, Hamas, and so on, and it takes their part. Now then we have Reshit Goyim Amalek. Amalek is the first of nations. That means, even though there are many nations, they have a first, they have a reshit, they have a head. What is that first? That's Amalek. And in this Amalek, in this head, there are two things. One is that Amalek is the head of all the other nations, but he's not one of them. In other words, he's separate from the other nations, but he is their leader. And the second point is that even though he's separate from them, he connects with them. And that's why it's called Reshit Goyim, the first of the nation, because he is separate and yet he's connected with them. Now, so here we have a kind of, political presentation of what is Amalek, what are the other nations, the way the other Amalek is higher than the other nations, it's separate, it's in a different category, and nonetheless, it has an influence on the other nations. Now, all that is referring to nations who the Jewish people had to battle when they came out of Egypt, then later when they went into Israel, and they had the battles with the nations there. And later on, there was still Amalek, and King Saul tried to get rid of Amalek, and he didn't do it properly, he wasn't successful. And we have Amalek in the time of Haman. Halachically, by the time we get to the time of the Talmud, 1,500 years ago, the Talmud regards the ancient nations as having disappeared. They've intermingled with other nations. And so even though in the time of the Talmud there was a nation called Amalek, they didn't see those people as necessarily being the same people that we're talking about here. And so therefore, in the time of the Talmud, there was someone who came from the tribe or the people of Amalek, and he converted to Judaism. And he's referred to as the Amalekite proselyte, Ger Amaleki. So they didn't see the people of Amalek of having extended to our time. So we might see Amalek as a kind of a spiritual force that we have to fight against, but it's not necessarily identifiable with a particular people. That's just in halachic terms. The Rambam says the same thing, that these ancient nations, with all the different strictures about them of different kinds, they've been absorbed in other nations around them, and so even though they may have the same name, you can't identify them. However, the path that this discourse is taking is not the path of the political question: which nation is Amalek, and what's the relationship of Amalek to the other nations, and who are the other nations? Whether any of those nations are the people now in the land of Israel, or claiming the land of Israel. No, we are looking at the whole situation inside each individual. That inside each individual, there are spiritual dimensions, psychological dimensions, which relate on the one hand to the seven nations of the land of Israel, And on the other hand, Swamali. Now, the first point is, as mentioned before, that the sages tell us that when it says that Amalek came and battled with Israel in the place called Rephidim, and Rephidim means being weak, they weakened their hands from the study of Torah. So the fact that the person is weak in study of Torah, that gives room for Amalek to come. And that's the whole idea of measure for measure. Since there's the idea of Amalek coming, and relating to Kael Zah Asher Bekirbecha, the foreign god is inside you, that each person has a foreign god inside them, that's the evil desire. Now, this comes out like from that spiritual reality inside the Jewish people, eventually down chains through the steps of from the spiritual into the physical, that you have the physical people of Amalek attacking the Jewish people. And similarly, the battle with the other nations. In general, they are the seven nations, from the seven nations who inhabited the land of Israel, and God told us that we have to go and conquer them, and we have to settle the land of Israel ourselves. Now, from this we understand that according to the way we understand this service in the soul of the person, we can all, whether it is, we can understand the difference between the battle against Amalek and the battle against the other seven nations. So since the general idea of the service of God is one nation struggling against another inside us, and so that idea of the animal soul being one force inside us, the divine soul being the other force, and they're struggling together. Now, we can understand from the way it is in physical and quartz terms, we can understand how it relates to how it is in our spiritual, inner spiritual struggle that is inside ourselves. And also, we can see a kind of a mirror image of this whole thing in a realm which is spiritual, the task of the person, the divine soul that every individual Jew, man and woman has got. And that that individual has got these two concepts. He or she has got the idea of nations, the seven nations. And it's also, he or she has also got the idea of the first of nations, which is Amalek. So there's the nations which are inhabiting the land of Israel. And there are those seven nations inside our own hearts. And there's also the first of nations, which is Amalek, the way that is inside each person in a sacred realm. Now, what this means is the soul, the neshama, divides in general into two aspects. One is the aspect of the soul, which is called the head, rosh, the head of the soul. And in greater depth, we can talk about the surrounding dimension of the soul. That's the head. The head and that which is surrounding. Now, makif, you see, means surrounding. It means a spiritual realm beyond. It's not in a pnimiyut. It doesn't come in an inward way. It's in a surrounding way. And something which is in a surrounding way, that is like the Amalek. That's the Amalek which is there. As we're going to see, or we're looking at it in holiness, and it's a higher dimension of the neshama. We have the neshama, which is holy, and we have chaya and yechida, which are higher dimensions of the soul, and which go beyond, and they are on a higher level, and they are the surrounding levels. And then we also have the inner dimension of the neshama, the pnimi, the inwardness. Now, that inwardness is like the seven nations. The seven nations are like the emotions or different aspects of the person. And then we have the surrounding aspect, which is, in sacred terms, the equivalent of Amalek. Now, the way that the discourse is going to analyze this now, it's going to look at different aspects of the soul. And in fact, this is quite a classic discourse for taking each of the different aspects of the soul and exploring it in depth. Now, the Midrash says that there are five names for the soul: Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Yechida. The truth is, if we were translating into English, each one, the best translation is soul. The only question is which aspect of the soul. So the lowest aspect of soul is Nefesh, and then is higher is Ruach, and then Neshama, and then there's even higher, Chaya and Yechida. Now, so first we explore Nefesh. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, they are the inner aspect of the soul. Chaya and Yechida, they are the surrounding aspects. So we've got the difference between the inward dimension and the surrounding dimension. But Chaya is the close surrounding dimension, and Yechida is the more remote surrounding dimension. Now, they're both surrounding, but if we want to use the words, which we have these convenient words, immanent and transcendent. So usually this is used about godliness, and we talk about the immanent aspect of the divine and the transcendent aspect of the divine. I think it's reasonable, since we're talking about the soul within the body, within the person. And there is a beautiful phrase which says by the sages, just as the soul fills the body, so God fills the universe. So we can talk about immanent, as I'm suggesting, immanent aspect of the soul and transcendent aspects of the soul. So at least those are two words that fit into the dictionary. So the immanent aspect of the soul is Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, the three aspects of the soul which are within. And then we have the transcendent aspects of the soul, which are Chaya, Yechida, which are beyond. So what it's going to do in this beautiful discourse, which we haven't got time to read every word of, unfortunately. So first, we're going to explain these three aspects of Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama. And so we're going to start with Neshama. And so it's now going to go through and explain Neshama. And then it's going to explain Ruach. And then it's going to explain Nefesh. And then it will come to the higher aspects of Chaya and Yechida, I think. But at this point, I'm going to stop sharing and see if we've got any questions or points that anyone would like to make. Rabbi Lou, do you have any comment on what we've got so far?
Beautiful. No, nothing to add, especially. Very, you know, very, very, gives a lot of tantalizing to see that Purim is not just carnivals.
Absolutely, yes. Purim is a time of tremendous joy, which is backed by many books. Nina, have you got any point?
I'm afraid I'm a bit lost.
You're lost.
I'm a bit lost with it, yeah.
Okay,
but
well, wait, just, so, well, so let's try and get back on board. The whole point of the pausing like this is to make sure we're all on board. So you see, we've got Amalek, and there's this crucial battle between the Jewish people and Amalek, which begins as soon as the Jews leave Egypt. Then we've got another set of seven tribes who inhabit the land of Israel, and there's a battle with them in order to conquer the land of Israel. Now, only in the case of Amalek did we have this intriguing strategy of Moses holding up his hands. And when he held up his hands, the Jews were successful, and not if he didn't hold up his hands. Which suggests that the battle with Amalek is on a different plane. The battle with the seven nations is one dimension, and the battle with Amalek is another. Now, when we translate that into, sorry about this ringing, I can't do anything about it. When we translate that into the person, the psychology of the person, the force of the seven nations is like the emotions of the person. And we can have emotions which need to be controlled in different ways. We need to master these emotions. And hopefully, that's a struggle that each individual has got. But then we've got the possibility of Amalek within the person. Now, Amalek's a different dimension. Amalek is described as the one who knows his master and deliberately rebels against him. Amalek is not emotion, it's intellectual. Amalek is the one who says, based on intellectual reasons, you think that the splitting of the Red Sea was a miracle? It was just by chance, or statistically this and that. There's no archaeological proof. That's so Amalek comes along with a kind of intellectual prirut, cooling, trying to dampen and cool ardor. The very opposite of the emotions. The emotions get very excited. Now, emotions might get excited over an inappropriate thing, or they might be diverted into a positive and very appropriate thing. But Amalek is different to that. So, in order to battle against Amalek, we need the help of the dimension that comes from Moses. See, that's the thing. In order to battle against the emotions, that's more straightforward. That's what it describes in Tanya, that we have an animal soul, we have a divine soul, we struggle, a person's attracted by this. He or she tries to control themselves, they try to divert, channel the emotion into a positive direction. But when it comes to Amalek, we need something on a higher level. And that higher level, that's the Moses. That's Moses holding up his hands. So that's the whole discourse in a nutshell. Okay. Okay. Unless anyone else has any point to make, let's get back into that.
So Malik is kind of a wise guy, someone who is a skeptic.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. Yeah. He's the wise guy, the skeptic, who yeah, absolutely. He reads a lot. Okay, so we get back to this text. Now, when we're talking about the divine soul is basically the seichel, the mind. Whereas the emotions, they come from the mind. However, in order to have healthy emotions, we really need the mind controlling the heart. Moch shalit alalev. The mind controls the heart. And that's the idea of the neshama, this deep part of the soul, which is in the mind. And what that means in sefirot, in the divine emanations, the sefirah bina, understanding. Now, this is an interesting thing about this discourse, that it puts understanding as the role of neshama. Whereas when we talk about Amalek or struggling with Amalek, like fighting back against Amalek, that's from Chokhmah, which is higher than Bina. Bina is understanding and Chokhmah is wisdom. So in the power, in the different qualities that a person has, that means understanding, grasping things. And as it explains in a section in Tanya, which goes through different sefirot. This is a beautiful section of Tanya, chapter in Igeret HaKodesh, in the fourth section of Tanya. It's section 15, and it goes through the different sefirot and the way that they are emotions within a person, and it speaks about them the way they are, as it were, normal daily emotions, and also the way that they are sacred emotions focused on the divine and on holiness. Now, the wisdom of the divine soul is understanding something divine, understanding something spiritual. Now, since godliness in general is divided into, now we're going to use those two words before that we found in the dictionary, immanent and transcendent, the immanent radiance of the divine, which flows down into everything and gives everything life, and the transcendent aspect, which is beyond the worlds, because, and but, so the transcendent here is described as surrounding the worlds, but there's also another level which is completely beyond the immanent or transcendent. And in relation to that third dimension, everything is like nothing, all existence, because there's only God. Now, the understanding that a person has goes from the simpler level to the more profound level. That means a person begins to contemplate. Now, here's a very beautiful thing, how to contemplate, right? So we could take out this little shtickle, this little bit, and make it into a fridge magnet and put it on the fridge, or put it on the, on the wall of the synagogue, or wherever one davens. Maybe one davens in a forest, so you could pin it to a tree. So a person begins contemplating the idea of the power of the creative energy, which is inside the created thing. Now, so since we left ourselves in a forest, let's start in a forest. So you look at a tree with leaves, and now in Britain, Europe, the Western world, or the our hemisphere, it's spring, and here we have the sap flowing, beginning to flow. You've got a creative energy from God in everything. And when you look at this tree or this plant, this flower, you can feel with your mind's eye, you can see with your mind's eye the creative power which is there from God. The way in which God fills the world in the same way that the soul fills the body, right? That same thing that I quoted before. It's a very beautiful concept, and it comes from Brachot, chapter page 10a. Very beautiful idea, the soul filling the body like God fills the world. And so we see how God created everything in the world in all its details. As we say, Marabu Maasecha Hashem, how great are your actions, O God. Sorry, how varied are your actions, O God. Umagadlu Maasecha Hashem, how great are your actions, O God. So everything is an expression of the divine. So we can look around. That is the first step, you could say, in contemplation. Looking around us, looking around, whether we're in a garden or a forest, or it could be in a room, wherever it is, and we're looking around and we're seeing the divine radiance and energy which is in everything. Then we can move a step higher. Then we start thinking about the way that God transcends the world. He's sovev kol amin, surrounding the world. And that means that this is an aspect of the divine which is on a higher order of infinity. The world is not able to contain this at all. As the sages say, he is the place of the world, but the world is not his place. Okay, this is the difference between Judaism and Spinoza or pantheism. Right, pantheism says, Spinozism, as people generally understand what Spinoza was saying, of course, he might have been saying something else, but let's assume he's saying what people say he's saying. He's saying that the whole universe, that's God. The universe, nature, everything, that's God. That's the divine, and there's no aspect of the divine beyond that. Whereas what we're saying is, God is the place of the universe, but the universe is not the place of God, because the universe is just a tiny, tiny little aspect of something created by the divine, and the divine is infinitely beyond that as well. And so from this, we come to a point of understanding godliness, or thinking about godliness in terms of which everything in existence is like nothing whatsoever. So we started off talking about that aspect of the divine that gives life to everything, the different leaves, the different trees, the birds, the animals, whatever it is. It's being given life by God. But now we're talking about an aspect of the divine which is completely beyond, in relation to which all the galaxies and the universe and all the spiritual realms, the world of Atzilut, it's all like nothing. It's all like nothing. There's just the infinite oneness of God. So all this is the way that the individual is able to think. And that is the power of Bina, of understanding. He or she is able to think in this kind of way, contemplate in this kind of way. And that is the thinking, so to speak, of the neshama. That's the soul thinking inside the person. And this is called panim masbirot, the face which explains, the aspect which explains. And that aspect which explains is a very significant thing. That's the that is bina, that's understanding, and that's coming from the neshama. The neshama, the soul, the deep part of the soul functioning as intellect in this sacred way. Now, I think we're going to miss this out, which goes into a more profound dimension, but we're going to come to here. Now, then we go to a higher level. We go to the level of wisdom. And wisdom is called panim me'irot, not the face which explains or the aspect which explains, but the aspect which shines. Because this is radiance, which is a revelation, a divine revelation. And there's also an aspect of wisdom which is beyond being revealed. So that's an even higher level. And we've got the idea that if it's revealed, there must be some kind of vessel which enables it to be revealed. The same way that if you have light shining, if you remember an old cinema, the light from the projector needs the screen in order to be seen. If it shines on the screen, you can see the light, you can see what's in the picture. If it's just going through the air towards the screen, you can't see it as light. You don't, it maybe picks up the cigarette smoke in the old days or the motes of dust, but it doesn't, you can't see any picture in it. So light needs a certain kind of vessel. And wisdom, chokhmah, is a kind of radiance without a vessel, right? Understanding is radiance with a vessel. Understanding is where the radiance has a vessel. The vessel is understanding, and you're able to think about the thing in detail at different levels. But wisdom is on a higher level. It's radiance without a vessel. And so that aspect of wisdom, which is called the panim me'irot, the face which shines, and bina, understanding, which is called the face which explains. See, this panim relates to the word patsufim, I think. There's a Kabbalistic word, which is the Aramaic word for face, called patsuf. So everything has different in the sefirot. There is this patsuf and that patsuf. I think maybe what the Rebbe is doing in this is adapting this sort of Kabbalistic term into these phrases. Maybe Rabbi Liu will put me right, and there's another reason. But it's an unusual phrasing, and one way of understanding it is in relation to the term patsufim. Which the Rebbe actually mentioned. He mentioned the word patsuf. You see, bina is a patsuf shalem. Bina is a full visage. And what does it mean by being? And so he explains that it's the idea of the face which explains, whereas wisdom is the face which shines. Now, so all this is about the relationship of wisdom and understanding, and understanding is like the vessel which holds the radiance of wisdom. But wisdom in itself is on a higher level. Now, somewhere there was a quotation from another discourse by the commentator. You know, there's this commentary around this, very useful commentary. So the commentator made the point that wisdom is like a lightning flash. And understanding is our rational thought. Now, a lightning flash is a beautiful revelation, but we have no control over it. We don't know when the lightning flash is going to shine. And when it does shine, we quickly look, you know, and see what we're able to see. And then we think about it. Our thinking about it, which is Bina, understanding, that's in our control. We can think about it for 5 minutes. We can say, I'm going to stop thinking about it. I have to do something else. I'm going to have a coffee and then I'll think some more. We're in control of it. But the lightning flash, we're not in control. The lightning flash happens. So that's the difference or way of expressing a difference between wisdom and understanding. So then we have ruach. Now ruach is lower. Ruach is another word for soul. Yeah, I mean it means spirit. Neshama can be related to the word neshima, which means breath. Ruach is also like wind. Nefesh also means breath. And so, but so we can translate the words as soul. But now ruach is like the emotions in the heart. And the idea is that in the heart, there are different emotions. It's true that ideally, in a way, the emotions come from the mind cogitating, and through that, the emotions are born. But in fact, many emotions are there anyway in the hearts. The thinking of the mind might guide the emotions. So there's a sort of a subtle interrelationship between the mind and the heart. So there's sort of more primitive emotions which don't have anything to do with the mind at all. Then there are more sophisticated emotions which do derive from the mind, and there's a sort of interaction between them. And the fact is that emotion can have a tremendous power on its own. Just because it's emotion is rooted in a very powerful way. It says over here, the emotions are like a storm, like thunder. Rash, Sturm puts it in Yiddish. The emotions are like in a powerful storm, unlike the intellect. The intellect's more subtle and thinking. So the thing is, these emotions. We have emotions. Actually, the emotions are there in the neshama as well, but they're not obvious. And then they become more clear, and through the power of the mind, they're awoken. And so that's the idea of the mind arousing and controlling the emotions. So we've got neshama, which is primarily mind, and which we saw two different aspects of the mind, whether it's bina, which is like the real power of the mind, and then there's chokhmah, which is wisdom, which is beyond. And then there's ruach, which is emotions, which have got a subtle interaction with the power of the mind. And then we have nefesh. Now, nefesh, the lower aspect of the soul, relates to kaved. Kaved means the liver. And what that means for the medieval thinkers and the Kabbalists is it's action. And that action means behaving in a certain way, turning away from bad and doing good. We're talking about positive, good, sacred action. And so much so that the person's nefesh has been triggered off, this lower aspect of their soul has been triggered off in such a positive way that they must keep the 248 positive mitzvahs and they must negate and run away from the 365 negative mitzvah as God desires from us and tells us in the Torah how to behave. And within these actions, there's also love and awe of God. Because it says in Tanya, love is the root of all the positive mitzvahs. And without love, the positive mitzvahs don't have a real existence. They're not permanent. They're not sustainable without the power of love within them. And the one who really keeps the mitzvahs properly is the person who loves God and wants to cleave to God. And similarly, awe is the basis of all the negative mitzvahs. So there's the possibility of doing mitzvahs without any special attention, just keeping them without any special energy, and without any special emotion. But when the when we keep mitzvahs with emotion, with love, and with awe, and with devotion to God, then the mitzvah is being kept properly, and it's sustainable. It's going to go on and on and on. Now, all these aspects have to be given over by the soul. Everything that we learned about in this piece, this very beautiful standalone piece of this discourse, right? We can, this part of the discourse is something that relates to many different discussions in Hasidic thought, and it really is, could be like a standalone description of the different aspects of the soul. Quite apart from our earlier discussion about Amalek and the seven nations, all these aspects have to be devoted to the divine. And in fact, that is the shlichut of the soul in the world. It's come down in the world in order that even though the soul is down here in the world far from godliness, we have to be able to develop all these different aspects and then connect them with the divine in a very intense way. Now, then we come to a further level. Because the soul can achieve all these things on the level of bina, of understanding. But there's also a higher dimension. So the command from God is not only we should understand, but da et Elokei avicha, know the God of your father, know God. So that means not only understanding through wisdom, through understanding, through bina, and everything connected with it. We also have to have study in such a way that we reach the level of wisdom and the level of keter, of crown, which is higher and higher. So we have to go to even higher levels, to the source of the soul. And because there is the essence of the divine, and the essence of the divine is beyond all these definitions, whether it's wisdom or understanding. We have to try to go to a level completely beyond, and that means within ourselves as well, connecting to God on a completely supernal level. And that's a level that we have to reach for so that we should be able to be free of anything which isn't godliness. Liot mushlalim mikol davar she'eino elokut. To be free of anything which isn't godliness, totally bonded with the divine. Now, all that is happening through The power of the soul, the nefesh, the ruach, the neshama, which is within us. Then the discourse comes also to the aspect of chaya and yechida in the soul. Now they are the transcendent aspect of the soul, and they're not linked with any particular part of the person. It's not linked with the intellect. It's not linked with the emotions. It's not linked with our actions. It's something which transcends. It's something which is absolutely beyond. And so that is, and so that is being identified here with the power of wisdom, which is beyond. Wisdom is like the end of the Makifin. You see, Keter surrounds. Keter means crown. It's the highest of the Sefirot, and it, so to speak, surrounds. Then comes Chochmah, which is normally seen as an inward quality among the Sefirot. In this discourse, it's seen as the final aspect of the surrounding dimension, and then begins Bina, understanding, which is within. And so here we're talking about the aspect of wisdom, which is total selflessness. Now, this total selflessness, that is the level of Chaya, and even more Yechida. Now, this selflessness of wisdom, because we have a interesting teaching in the name of the Maggid of Mezrich by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, which he writes in Tanya, that wisdom is the quality of selflessness. Now, that quality of selflessness, it goes beyond the understanding in the mind of Bina, of understanding, and it goes beyond the emotions, and it's beyond everything. Now, this selflessness, which is the point, Shehu levado hu ve'en, God is alone, he alone is God, and there's nothing apart from him. Now, this means that there's, in some sense, some negative thing that we are. What does it mean? He alone is he, and there's nothing apart from him. Of course, what are we trying to negate by saying this? So here we come to. Sorry, I'm going swiftly through this. Now, so we have that very high level. We have that very high level within us. And the question is, how does that high level get revealed? You see, our ordinary avodah is in terms of the struggle that we have with the emotions and so on, the lower dimension. That's where we have the normal area of where we are, that we have a struggle and we go step by step. But then there's something which is completely beyond. And that level beyond, that is the level of self-sacrifice. That's the level where the Jew is not able, deep down, is not able to be separated from godliness. And that is something absolutely beyond. Now, that is our deepest, deepest quality. So here you have at the top of the page, Mesirut Nefesh. This giving up, the readiness to give up our life for Judaism, that's all for the Jewish people. That quality is something which is the deepest aspect of our being, and it is beyond the kind of step-by-step service of the divine that we have in the kind of catalogue of self-mastery that we have at lower levels. This is something completely beyond. So now we finally come to discuss the difference between the battle against Amalek compared with the battle against the other nations. When the Jewish people had to go into the beautiful land of Israel, where the service of God is in an organized way, in an inward way, there we have the battle with the seven nations. They are like the seven emotions. And we've got to work them through in a positive way and channel them and so on. But when the battle is not in the land of Israel, the battle is in the desert, then it's the battle of Amalek. And then it's the battle of the first of nations is Amalek, which is in such a way of at the same time being the first and also being separate, but he still has a connection with them. Now, for that, we need another level of holiness. We need a different dimension, higher than understanding. And that is total surrender, total abandon in godliness, you could say, the way it is of Yechidah, of the essence of the soul, the highest transcendent level of the soul, of which it says, we didn't read it, but it was in a previous paragraph, Chavuka udvuka bach. Embracing and cleaving you, infinite divine, Yechidah liyachdach, the only one unifying you, that only one is our essence. Or at least the complete selflessness of wisdom, which is the level of Chaya. So there's a level of Chaya and higher up the level of Yechidah. And that level of Chaya is that he alone exists and there's nothing apart from him. And so that quality is the quality which goes to completely transcends understanding and ordinary intellectual faculties. Now, that is really the battle against Amalek, because Amalek is the contradiction to us on that deepest level. It's the coldness, it's the rationalization. It's the saying that the miracle isn't a miracle and that everything is ordinary and everything can be reduced to a simple whatever it is. And that coldness of the rational Amalek, the kfirah, the atheism of Amalek, that is the higher level of battle within us. So it's quite different to the battle we might have with inappropriate desires. There, the person's alive, he's got inappropriate desires. All right, channel those inappropriate desires and make them a desire for Torah, a desire for godliness, a desire for mitzvot. Channel it with the same heat, with the same passion. But here we're talking about coldness instead of passion, and it's an intellectual coldness. So there we have this quality of Amalek. And Amalek is not bothered by the tremendous miracles that took place at the going out of Egypt. He finds some sort of rational excuse, explaining them away, and that's why he is able to attack us. Now, so even though Amalek sees a number of things which he should really have been very excited about, look at the power of God, look how God is protecting the Jewish people. No, he is in a mood of coldness and he makes us cold as well. So, therefore, how do we fight Amalek? It's not through a rational battle, but it's through a service which is higher than rationality. And it begins with the power which comes from the level of Chaya, which is the transcendent dimension of wisdom and going higher. Now, so therefore, what we have at this point is that the discourse is going to explain the way in which, on the one hand, when Moses was there, there is this power which goes beyond rationality, is him lifting up his hand. At another time, and in our time, it's something else. And we're going to identify that. It's spiritual components to our lives, which, if we are able to utilize their power, give us the same effect as Moses holding up his hands. Now, let's see that. Now, first of all, we have Moses. Moses is the person who expresses, on that one hand, he expresses wisdom. Remember, we're locating Amalek at the level of this wisdom, but in the wrong way, while understanding is where the soul is, Amalek is at this higher point. Now, Moses is on this higher level of wisdom, but also He is completely absorbed with the divine, so much so that his physical body was able to experience prophecy without in any way interrupting its normal functions. Other prophets would prostrate themselves or could only have a prophecy when they were asleep and they have a dream. Not so Moses. This Shechinah medaberet mitochrono, the divine presence speaks through the throat of Moses. So in other words, the divine expresses itself through him. That's why he's the Raya Mehemna, the faithful shepherd of the whole Jewish people. And he is able to arouse Titore b'chinat Moshe shebechol echad. Moses is able to arouse the quality Moses in each individual Jew. And through this, we all become Anshei Moshe. We become the people of Moshe, the followers of Moshe. And then we're able to have this power that we are able to conquer Amalek. So that's what Moses is able to achieve for us. He lifts up his arms, and this brings about the revelation of the Amalek, the revelation of the power which can defeat Amalek inside us. Now, one second, because I thought we have over here what happens nowadays. Okay, it must be further on. Now, here we have, okay, there's a very interesting section that we're missing out. I'm sorry. We just have to skip over it. Now, it explains in books. Which he gives references here. They found references to Hasidic teachings. When the Rebbe said it explains in books, he might have had other books in mind, but we don't know. And so the editors, who were very scholarly men, who put together this edited, their edited edition of this discourse, they found references in Hasidic teachings, but there might be some other book that the Rebbe had in mind. The way that we, so now we're coming to us, right, in 2025. How can we conquer the Battle of Amalek? Now, it might sound extreme, it might sound deceptively simple, but in fact, it's incredibly profound. The way we are able to conquer and be successful in the battle against Amalek in our individual service is by reading in the Torah the chapter that's going to be read this week. This week is going to be read the chapter Zachor, remember Amalek, from the second Torah scroll, from Ki Tetzeh. Because when we read in the Torah, Yesh Gilui Bechinat Pnimiyot Or Ein Sof, there's a revelation of the inner radiance of the infinite, right? In many shuls, people chat during the reading of the Torah. They go out and talk about something else. But what it's saying here is that when the Torah is being read, whenever the Torah is being read, it's an incredible thing, and one should be trying to follow in the Chumash, follow and see what's being read. But apart from that, this second Torah scroll, which actually is regarded as a mitzvah from the Torah to hear this second Torah scroll because there's a command, remember what Amalek did. And by reading this Torah in this second Torah scroll, this Shabbat, we are doing that. And so, therefore, for example, women make a great effort to come to shul, even if they don't usually come in the area where I live. Where many young women have children, and so there's no Eruv, so they're not able to come to shul in the morning. They have a special reading of the Torah in the afternoon on Shabbat, where the men can stay with the children, and the women will go to the synagogue and hear the reading of the Torah, the section on Amalek. This is a very, very significant thing. But what is happening is, it's not It is a mitzvah from the Torah, which is an incredible thing, but also it is a revelation of the inwardness of the radiance of Ein Sof, of the infinite. And that's something which is beyond knowledge, beyond understanding. And so therefore, this reading in the Torah, Koreu Mamshech, it draws down the zachor, this memory, this remembering of Amalek, until it comes out that we are destroying, erasing the memory of Amalek. And then there's another way to eradicate Amalek, through action, practical action, the practical mitzvot, to try and keep the mitzvot in a beautiful way, in a way of doing it in an extra way. And the Rebbe here speaks about the idea of tefillin, have tefillin which are really mehudah, which are really good tefillin, and they've been written by a very good scribe, and who is a God-fearing man. And the batim, the houses, as it were, the covering of the tefillin, they should, the boxes of the tefillin should also be made by an expert who is God-fearing, and then we should wear them in the right way. And when we're wearing them, we should keep our minds focused on them. And similarly, with all other mitzvot, having a certain mindful focus on the mitzvot that we are doing. And that is the power. That is the power which is beyond rationality. That is a power where the divine comes into our life from the beyond, from the complete transcendent beyond. And so, because there are actually two ways in which we conquer Amalek. There's conquering Amalek from above to below, because God says, I will wipe out the memory of Amalek. And there's also conquering Amalek from below, which is us doing what we are able to do. And so, in these two directions, whether it's the way in which that there is the reading of the Torah, which comes from God, which is above, and there's also the mitzvah, which comes from above, because God gives us the mitzvah and we do them, all that is God wiping out this memory of Amalek, and we have to play our part. And so to speak, be vessels, be kelim, be able to accept this radiance and be able to do this, to be able to take part in this spiritual transaction that we allow God to enter our lives through hearing the Torah, through the mitzvah being done in a very beautiful way, every mitzvah, whatever it is. And in that way, the godliness enters us and eradicates the Amalek. And then we have the idea of the way in which we are able to transform the seven emotions, which might be inappropriate, and that all we need to do is to think in the right way and contemplate in the right way, as described before. And here we have to go a step higher, and it's by going to this step higher, which is the step of self-sacrifice, then we are able to reach this quality of eradicating Amalek, and with Amalek as the first of the nations, eradicating all our enemies in such a way, coming back to actual physical enemies, and through that coming to the Geula Amitit Vashlema, the true and complete redemption through Mashiach Tzidkenu, very swiftly, Mamash.